This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The publication Stateline just released its annual legislative review. It's a state-by-state glance at the political and public policy trends that have bubbled up in state legislatures. This year's big topics include Medicaid expansion, gun control, and how the Me Too movement has shaped policy and behavior. Joining us now to talk about the review is Barbara Barrett. She's a former reporter for the News and Observer, who's now the managing editor of Stateline. It's a nonpartisan publication of the Pew Charitable Trusts. Barbara, welcome.
Hi, it's so good to be with you.
Welcome back. Good to talk with you. And WUNC Capital Bureau Chief Jeff DeBeery here from family leave. Congratulations.
Thank
having
you.
Raised a child now.
Almost 4 months.
Almost 4 months. Nice work. Welcome back.
Appreciate it.
Barbara, tell us about this report, because I know you've been looking at trends. This is what Stateline does, kind of goes state by state. We see the national headlines, the impact that they may be having on state legislatures. So what do we see just generally about concerns in state legislatures across the country?
Sure. So stateline.org, as you mentioned, is a news publication that looks at state legislatures around the country. We really focus pretty heavily on state policy issues. It's a great nonprofit outfit. I'm so happy to be here because, as you know, coverage has sort of gone down in a lot of states. North Carolina, I think, is an exception. We have really good coverage of Raleigh there. But we do a annual look every summer. It's called our legislative review. This is about the time that a lot of legislatures are wrapping up their work for the year. And so we take a look at the trends that have emerged. And as you mentioned, there were several trends that came out of this. We expected that there would be some red state, blue state divides in a lot of cases. We had predicted earlier this year that there would be a lot of pushback against the Trump administration. That was pretty easy to predict, actually, on different things. But we also noticed in a few cases that you see some blue states, some red states, not necessarily working together, but you saw some trends that did actually cross political lines.
So tell us about some of those.
Sure. So for example, Medicaid expansion, we thought this was very interesting. As your listeners know, a few states, North Carolina was not among them, expanded Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act. There is a push by many states to expand work requirements under Medicaid. This is part of a concept called skin in the game, where there's an effort to see people who receive public benefits sort of give something back or put skin in the game, whether that's co-pays or work requirements or what have you. There have been some political calculations in some states that, okay, well, maybe work requirements are a way to get more Medicaid assistance to more people in the state. And on the other side, of course, Medicaid expansion is perhaps a way to get more people giving more back in exchange for benefits. So that's fairly interesting. North Carolina, as I mentioned, has not expanded, but has sort of put forward a policy that should it expand, it would want to add work requirements to that expansion.
Well, Jeff DeBeery, tell us more about that here in North Carolina.
So the lack of expansion on Medicaid is something that has been discussed ad nauseum for 6 or 7 years now. And I think that if you look at the two chambers of the North Carolina legislature, there has been more of an appetite, more of an interest from the Republicans in control on the House side to consider expanding Medicaid, to talk about it, to, in fact, study whether or not it would be good and how much money it would cost. That actually made its way into a piece of legislation earlier this year. The House approved that. They said, we're going to set aside some money and we're going to look at the benefits and the costs of expanding Medicaid. Got over to the Senate, and the Senate ripped that language right out of the bill. So I think that that's one piece of it. I mean, you've got, as we've talked about in the program many times, different caucuses, different constituencies for House Republicans compared to Senate Republicans to some degree. And I think one of the other things that is going to be interesting is the litigation that came out of Kentucky, right? So there was this work requirement. It was struck down by a federal court. Are there going to be subsequent appeals? And I think part of this is a waiting game, or trying to see from the North Carolina lawmakers' standpoint, is a work requirement going to be held up by potentially a circuit court or the U.S. Supreme Court? And then would they move forward with that in place?
Yeah, because that's a state, even in a state that hasn't expanded Medicaid. Barbara, tell us more about that decision, the Kentucky decision, and the impact that it has had, if any, on other state legislatures.
So it was a district case, so it's not sort of wide-reaching on its face. However, as Jeff mentioned, it will have an impact on what others decide to do. Basically, one of the reasons that Kentucky wanted to impose work requirement was that expected to save money, about $33 million, because that would cut off about 90,000 people. Not necessarily because all those people wouldn't work, but because there are all kinds of paperwork requirements and people would end up falling off the rolls. That's actually one of the arguments that some people make against work requirements. The judge wondered how the state was going to ensure the people who lost Medicaid would get medical assistance, since that's sort of the point of Medicaid. So you have four other states, there's Kentucky in addition to Arkansas, Indiana, and New Hampshire, who have received approval for work requirements. Right now, basically, as Jeff mentioned, there's sort of a waiting game to see what will happen with that case. Kentucky plans to appeal.
And Jeff, here in North Carolina, Roy Cooper is behind this idea. In other words, it is a way to expand Medicaid if it costs a work requirement. He's so far signaled that he would be in favor of that.
He is. That is, Stop the Press's the middle ground, some actual compromise that has been put on the table. And we'll see if it ever amounts.
All right. So we've got a couple of things, both the political dynamics around expanding Medicaid at all, and then whether or not this court decision, has an impact here in North Carolina. Do we see any? So you don't know. In reading the tea leaves, you can't tell, Jeff, how far this might go at this moment.
Well, I think the biggest... Some of this will largely depend on what happens in November. Will the Democrats end a Republican supermajority in the House? If so, does this then become a major bargaining chip for the Democrats? Say, we are pressing for Medicaid expansion. We're going to do everything we can to stop everything you want to push through until we get that or till we get part of that. Or if you want to, I guess, go with a bigger proverbial if Democrats were to take back the North Carolina House this year, I think the issue of Medicaid expansion could become much more front and center in 2019.
All right, let's talk about another issue that came up in the State Line annual legislative review, Barbara, immigration. Talk about what's going on, quite a bit of diversity and a lot of dynamics around immigration, Barbara.
Right. So as your listeners know, immigration is largely a federal enforcement issue, but that has not stopped local and state governments from getting involved. Y'all have heard of sanctuary cities. There's now an effort to look at either sort of sanctuary states or anti-sanctuary states. North Carolina has not been as involved in this, but I can tell you that California, for example, has established itself as a pro-sanctuary state. It would like for its local law enforcement agencies to not work with ICE on enforcement. There are a couple of local communities that are pushing back on that. Texas is sort of the opposite. They want their local communities to work with ICE enforcement. Austin, in particular, has pushed back against that and declared itself a freedom city. In North Carolina, there was a bill this spring that would cut state funding for sanctuary cities, although my understanding is that there are no actual sanctuary cities in North Carolina.
Well, tell us more about that, Jeff. Where are we at the moment?
That's correct. Quick synopsis is 3 years ago, the legislature banned sanctuary cities here, and then in 2017, they moved to say that they were going to take away state funding for cities that were violating this state ban. But to date, despite what some of the folks in leadership have said, you know, these cities are operating from a sanctuary standpoint. We don't have any examples of this, and there has not been any state money or state appropriations that have been cut from municipalities.
All right. And to as you said, Barbara, this is really a national, federal issue, but there are some gray areas where local law enforcement is invited to and incentivized to work with ICE, and so therefore there's some flexibility for local law enforcement, and that's where sanctuary city would come in. Localities prohibiting or not their local law enforcement from taking advantage of these invitations to become more active in immigration.
Sure, that's certainly one aspect of it.
Let's talk more about the politics of this, though, because if we look at across the country, we'll come back to North Carolina, but Barbara, nationally, if you talk about particularly the Hispanic vote, but the progressive vote is becoming more engaged over these issues. Is there a way of looking at a state-by-state basis of where these issues, obviously along the border, but whether or not immigration becomes an important factor in November?
You know, that is not something that we have looked at per se, because we're usually more policy-based, but obviously I think that that's something readers and listeners can be paying attention to as they follow these things. You know, the same with Medicaid, just about everything that state legislatures do has a political aspect to it. So it makes sense, of course, to pay attention to what's going to be happening in November.
And what about here in North Carolina? Just talking about the political impact, is this a top of line issue here in North Carolina, Jeff?
I don't think it's a top of line issue here in North Carolina. I think there are a number of things that are going to play into November. I mean, really a number of things. One thing I'll just quickly touch on that I think is interesting is if you look across the country, and perhaps Barbara can speak more to this, there are, I believe it's just about 400 seats in state legislatures that are currently held by Republicans in districts that Hillary Clinton won in 2016. Mm-hmm. There are eight such districts in North Carolina where there are eight Republicans who are in areas that Hillary Clinton won. So I think some of what we're talking about here is it's a push or it's a lean toward the middle, because you have some of these districts that they kind of lean, they reach out both ways, if that makes sense.
Well, another issue where we've seen some movement where there has been very little in recent decades is gun control. The Las Vegas shooting at Parkland School brought on certainly gun control once again, but unlike other shootings, this one seemed to have an impact. Bump stocks became an issue of concern for lawmakers. Tell us what your report found, Barbara.
Sure. So we reported earlier this year that after following past mass shootings, state legislatures were more likely to actually pass laws that expanded gun rights rather than restricted gun rights. That was true in part in North Carolina, although obviously the legislature switched over to Republican control in 2011, just before the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012. So, you know, that obviously had a big impact there as well. But what we found was been that since Parkland, there have been more than 50 new gun control laws passed in states across the country. Now, some states haven't passed any. Some states have passed more than one. But it's certainly something that's been reaching out across the aisle. There were 14 states with Republican governors that passed new gun control laws of various types. And there are different kinds. You know, you mentioned the bump stock ban. There were 10 states that banned bump stocks. That was the device that was used in the Las Vegas shooting last fall that turned a semi-automatic gun into an automatic gun. There are other things that states looked at, like expanding background checks. A couple of states banned large capacity magazines. A few states tightened laws that to keep domestic abusers from owning guns. And several states have looked at what are known as red flag laws. Now, these are also known as extreme risk protection orders. And it's basically a situation where if there's a person who's considered a potential danger, then it allows law enforcement to petition for the opportunity to remove guns from the household temporarily.
Jeff, we saw some interest in tighter gun control in North Carolina, but then it seemed to fade.
So to pick up on that last point, the protection orders were talked about, were proposed here, perhaps most forcefully by a Democrat from Durham County named Marsha Morey, who's a former former judge. But that did not go anywhere. And I think what Republicans in leadership did, and I think they threaded the needle very carefully, was they recognized there was a groundswell here, but they steered this away from actual gun reform, and they looked at school safety. So they reframed the conversation as best they could, and what they did was they formulated a school safety resource commission. And, you know, they met several times, and they did their best to have all the TV cameras there, and they really talked about what they could do to provide more money for school resource officers and school counselors and so on and so forth. And they, by and large, did their best to change the narrative. So there was no, and you know, polls have indicated that North Carolinians, as is the case nationally, by and large support tighter background checks for people with mental health histories and domestic histories of domestic violence. But nothing of that sort moved forward here.
Let's talk more about, I know, Barbara, you talked about policy being the centerpiece of the state line report, but you did take a look at the impact of politics. The Me Too movement, certainly covered in this legislative review. How did sexual harassment or that factor into this report?
Well, kind of like the gun control issue, I think people sort of recognized that there was a groundswell movement, that something was happening this year. We have covered a lot of issues on sexual harassment within legislatures. Earlier, you know, over the course of this past year, there were over 30 people who left office after being connected in some way to accusations of harassment, which was quite a few. The Associated Press recently reported that a couple of dozen people who also were accused of harassment are either still in office or have run for re-election to office. So that's just sort of the sexual harassment issues on its face. And obviously you guys have a case in North Carolina that Jeff can probably talk about a little bit in more detail. But I think it also had an impact on what legislatures did on issues surrounding women's rights, women's safety, that sort of thing. Rape kits, for example, were a big issue in North Carolina this year. And that was true of other places as well. You know, it's been reported over several years that a lot of rape kits, thousands and thousands across the country, are sitting on shelves, untested. It costs money to test them, but it could not only help catch perpetrators, but also exonerate people who may have been wrongfully accused. So that was something that a lot of states tackled, including North Carolina, which my understanding is that the Attorney General's office asked for money from the legislature this year, didn't get the money that they wanted, but have said that they're going to try to set up a tracking system going forward that helps victims in new cases figure out what's happening with the kits that might have been collected in their cases.
Tell us more about that, Jeff.
There was more traction with rape kits in the state this year than there were on new policies pertaining to sexual harassment or independent reporting procedures. One of the elements of nuance here in the state is that with the backlog of untested kits, many of them are at the local level and not the state level, but there does appear to be a better system of tracking it moving forward, and I do believe some more funding to go toward reducing that backlog at the county level.
Here's an issue that only obliquely affects the state of North Carolina, it being a right-to-work state and one of the least unionized states in the country. But that's not to say that labor isn't an issue here, particularly when it comes to professionals like teachers. Union power and collective bargaining, a big trend this year with policymakers. Barbara, tell us what your report found.
Sure. So as you mentioned, North Carolina wasn't really affected by the Janus decision, which was the Supreme Court decision that said that unions can't automatically collect fees. But a lot of blue states elsewhere in the country expected that this decision would come down. They passed laws that made public sector unions, those are the unions that include teachers, firefighters, police officers, that sort of thing, that made it easier for them to retain membership. About a third of public officials and government workers are in a union like that across the country. So for those blue states, it's a big deal. They would do things like ensure that unions had contact information for new hires so that they could reach out to them directly, that sort of thing. At the same time, there will be a financial hit to unions, and there's some sense that that could have an impact indirectly in places such as North Carolina. As you know, unions spend a lot of money on political campaigns, and they spend that money not only in union states, but also in right-to-work states, both for local and federal elections. If they have less money to spend, it might affect their influence over local political elections.
Or not, because what we're seeing in the Democratic Party is the same revolution we saw in the Republican Party. That is to say, all the institutional old ways you used to do business, raise money from unions, etc. We want a whole new way of doing things. We saw a lot of teachers who are not technically unionized in the state protesting. What are the dynamics in the state, Jeff, when it comes to the politics of, for instance, teachers and their impact in November?
You're going to ask me that question with just a few seconds left to go.
Less than 20 seconds.
I appreciate that. Welcome back. What we saw in May,
your baby is crying.
What we saw in that, well, that's because it's such a short window to answer this question. It's such a fascinating question. It's such a fascinating issue. There were 20,000 teachers that showed up to downtown Raleigh in May asking for higher pay and more resources, and actually for the expansion of Medicaid for students who have mental health challenges and who are Title I and living in poverty. By and large, we did not see a response, a direct response from legislators to teachers and educators, in terms of those demands. So voter turnout, as we've talked about, is going to be fascinating, and it will be interesting to see what kinds of rallies there are again and again moving forward.
You're an amazing reporter and probably a great father.
I appreciate it. Thank you,
Jeff Tiberius, WNC's Capital Bureau Chief. Barbara Barrett is Managing Editor of Stateline, a nonpartisan publication of the Pew Charitable Trust. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Always.
Just ahead, we'll get a preview of a glass exhibit in Western North Carolina. Stay with us on the State of Things.